Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to The Hobcast Book Show. It's show number 60.
Number 60. I can't quite believe that.
No, I can't. But anyway, welcome to the show. I'm Agent Hobart.
I'm Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hoback Books, UK independent publishers of the following genres.
Crime.
Mysteries.
Suspense.
And thrillers.
I was worried you'd forgotten then.
Yeah, almost. Well, welcome to the show. And our guest this week is Awais Khan, a Pakistani-based writer who has a fabulous couple of books out, which are challenging, they're literate, and they're wonderful.
Yeah, very thought-provoking.
His most recent, No Honour, published by Arenda. But this interview is, it's life-affirming, it's brilliant.
It was just fun. The time went really quickly, as it often does when we talk to people. We didn't know what we were going to talk about. And yeah, it's just another really good, energetic, lively interview.
And really interesting to hear the perspective. Somebody sort of fighting to get published in the UK, but from Pakistan, where there is really very little in the way of a publishing industry at the moment. So, you know, the challenges and tribulations that Awais found. You know, I think you'll find inspiration in his tenacity and some of the, you know, he plenty of turndowns along the way, but eventually he found his agent and then his publisher. So yeah. It's great.
It's fantastic. Yeah, it's a really inspiring interview.
So to the news this week, and we, as you know, are very fond of Blackwell's Bookshop in Oxford. It's one of the best in the country. And it has a new owner, and you'll never guess who.
I'm going to stab in the dark at Hoback Books.
Yeah, well, we couldn't quite raise the funding this time.
We tried.
We did try. Yeah, spent hours putting together a bid.
But found in fact, some money down the side of the sofa.
It won't surprise you to learn that Waterstones.
Oh, Waterstones. Yeah, so, I mean, it was on the cards, wasn't it? So
yeah. Now, that is interesting. It's been greeted, according to the bookseller, positively by the publishers. We're talking about the big ones, Penguin Random House and HarperCollins and all those sort of people. And indeed by one or two of the sort of bodies that represent authors and the Independent Publishers Guild, which we're members of as well. But, I mean, it does mean that yet again there's another element of, I suppose, diversity within the UK book selling marketplace that has gone swallowed up by Waterstones.
And I suppose the hope is that they retain the culture of Blackwell's, because Blackwell's, yeah, you know, it's what, nearly 150 years since it
began? 148 years it's been within the same family. And they did hope at one stage to have a staff buyout, but that didn't work out.
No, unfortunately. And so it's got this sort of culture of academia and passion for books. And passion for not necessarily the mainstream books, you know, passion for anyone who's a quality writer. And the knowledge that the staff have that we've encountered when we went to Blackwell's in Oxford.
Yeah. They also own Heffers in Cambridge, which is the equivalent, really, with a fantastic reputation for, as you mentioned, academia and academic books. But in a more general sense, I mean, it's certainly Heffers of old, when I was growing up, was 90%. You know, really quite sort of niche academic books. It's become much more of a general bookseller nowadays.
Well, Blackwell's, they've got a lot of branches at university campuses, haven't they? We had one at Exeter.
That's right.
Yeah. I know Aberystwyth have got a Blackwell's, lots of campuses.
Well, I mean, I'm you know, they're going to keep the staff on, at least initially, so we'll see how that develops. But Blackwell's will continue, which I suppose is a positive.
And, indeed.
But under Waterstones' leadership, we'd like to celebrate at this point also an achievement for one of our former guests. Simon McLeave has made it to number one in the Nielsen eScan book charts.
Which is fantastic, isn't it? And that, so that is a sort of the definitive chart.
Yeah, I mean, you can look at your Amazon rankings, but when it boils down to it, the chart that matters in terms of ebooks is that one. Mm. And he's reached number one. So
fantastic.
Congratulations to him for his Snowdonia crime series. It's been a remarkable rise for him and continues to go from strength to strength. So we're celebrating that. Have you any news?
Well, as always, I always pick up on the quirky things, don't I? So we've talked about this before, how if you're a celebrity, you get picked up for sometimes your children's books writing or your biography. And then the sort of sports stars get picked up as well. And then more recently, Instagram sensations, as they call them. But even more recently than that, it seems to be that if you're a star on TikTok, you could get yourself a book deal.
Yeah, it is the nature of branding yourself in one of these platforms. Becoming a YouTube star was the thing.
Oh, yeah, that's
then
true.
It was Instagram, and now it is TikTok.
Yeah.
So what's the example?
Well, the one I saw was Man with a Pot. And Man with a Pot is a TikTok,
cooking show.
Yeah, yeah, cooking show. So I don't know if it's one man or I think it's Men with a Pot, actually. So I think it's more than one man. And all it is little videos of them cooking. And I watched one this morning. They're making apple pie. But it was very entertaining. But they've got a book deal to do a cookbook now. So that's fantastic for them. I'm really pleased that there are ways to get
noticed.
Get noticed and get published by fairly ordinary people when it goes down to it, you know.
Yeah.
So it's good.
The publishing industry are always looking for the next angle, aren't they? And that's what they've gone with. So congratulations to them.
And so as a result of this, I thought, okay, my amen is to get a book deal for the Hobbit cat. So I've been doing some videos of the cat on TikTok.
Endless videos of the cat.
Fingers
crossed.
Are
available on TikTok. And I'm sure our nearly 400 subscribers are loving every moment of the Hobbit Cat.
Well, I'm hoping they're going to follow us on TikTok.
Indeed. Let's get to Always Khan.
Absolutely.
And, we're very flattered. He listens to the show. And we're really gratified that he came on show. He's actually in London at the moment on a first-time visit for a couple of years now, since the pandemic. But has studied previously at Durham University. Not literature, it turns out. But he's also a graduate of the Faber Creative Writers Scheme, which is very sought after, and has two books out.
He does, and he's having a lovely time in London by the sound of it.
Yeah, bit of Harry Pottage. So we'll talk about that in a moment. Let's talk to Always Khan. Well, it's our very great pleasure to be speaking to Always Khan. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Adrian and Rebecca. It's really nice to be here, and thanks for having me.
And you're over in London at the moment, so welcome to the country. You find us in a state of flux, which is as a country. How's your journey been so far and your visit here?
Well, I just arrived, I think, 2 days ago, 1.5 days ago. So it's been really nice. It's always fun to be back in London. And this is my first time back in 2 years. So I the last time I was here was in March 2020, right before the pandemic. So I'm really, really happy to be here. And London is like a second home for me. So, yeah.
Of course. And we gather you've managed to squeeze in a bit of Harry Potter tourism as well.
That was the first thing I did.
Well, as soon as you got off the plane, you went straight to Harry Potter.
Yeah, it was kind of like that. It was I came in the late afternoon, and the next day, early morning, it was Harry Potter. So,
are you a big fan then of Harry Potter?
I am a huge fan. I was in school when it came out. So I think I was almost the same age, 9 or 10 when the first book came out. So I've read each of these books 50, 60 times, each of them. I'm a huge fan, as big as they come.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, I think my sister was about that age when they started coming out. And yeah. I remember having to take her to bookshops for midnight openings and stuff like that. Yeah,
The funny thing is that I, for the longest time, I think until I turned 13 or 14, I used to actually pray that I'd get a letter someday from Professor McGonagall. I literally believed it would happen. It was so strange, but I really did actually pray for that. Obviously, it didn't happen, but still.
Well, for my middle son, I actually fabricated a letter offering him his place at Hogwarts when he was sort of applying for secondary school. So he got a letter. He didn't believe it for a second, though. He said, "Oh, mother."
Oh, what a shame. You'd think he'd believe. But anyway, we'll move away from things Hogwarts and Quidditch and all that stuff. And let's talk about your author career. And let's get to the nub of it. I mean, we've been taking a look at, you know, some of the stuff that you know, your previous appearances in the media and things. And, you know, your journey to being a published author has not been an easy one, has it? Because at one stage, someone told you never to think about being an author. Well, tell us the story of that yeah. how that inspired you.
Well, absolutely. You're right. Because even though, I mean, we're a country of 220 million people in Pakistan, but we don't really have a lot of opportunities. We don't have any literary agents. Very few publishers, and the publishers we do have are so small that they can't really afford anything at all. So it's like it's a very difficult world in Pakistan, despite the population. So I remember when I was when I took the Faber course when I initially started out, because I felt that would improve my skills and everything. So after I'd taken it and started honing my book and everything, so I started submitting it to agents, and I remember I submitted it very widely. I got turned down by literally everyone. And one of them actually said that it's absolute drivel. It's rubbish. So it's probably better if you don't ever write again. So it was a huge blow to me, because as a Pakistani, it's so hard in any case. I mean, I'm not saying that it's not hard for any other writer in the UK or anywhere else in the world, but for Pakistanis, it's even more hard. It's harder. Mm. So I was like, you know, what am I even doing? Why am I even bothering with all of this? I should just give up. And you wouldn't believe, but I'm not lying. And the very next day, I got an email from Johnny Yeller asking for the full manuscript. And I was like, okay, now, no matter what anyone says, if Johnny Yeller thinks my book is good enough, I mean, even if he takes me on or not, I don't care. But if he's asked for a full manuscript, it means I'm a writer. So after that, I didn't let anyone tell me otherwise. So yeah.
Wow, that must have been some 24-hour sort of swing in emotion.
Literally was. It literally happened the next day. And there's so many things in my life that have happened like that. I remember when I was first, I did have an agent, and we were having a lot of trouble placing in the company of strangers with publishers in the UK. And yeah. I think 1.5 years later, I told her that, you know, I'm just going to go ahead and self-publish it because it's not happening at all. And my agent, she said that, okay, I understand. Give me 2 or 3 more weeks and then we can do whatever you want. And I think a week or two later, she called me. She said that we have a deal in the UK. And the very next day, she called me. She said we have a deal with Simon & Schuster as well in South Asia. And so it literally happened right before I was thinking of self-publishing. So it's like, it's really amazing how things, you know, sort of work out.
Mm, yeah, that is
serendipity strikes.
That is fantastic. That is fantastic. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's always one of the things that we talk about on this show is about that feeling, because all of us starting out writing, and I'm, you know, I've got the privilege of having my own publishing company, but I still haven't published a novel
yeah,
yet.
Yeah, you have to get past the gate though.
Yeah, exactly. I've got to get past Madam here. It is such a mountain just to get published, and then, or even noticed by an agent, and then to get signed up is another thing altogether. It's such a long process. And as you say, from your position of trying to do this from Pakistan, much, much, much tougher, even though the potential of the marketplace is enormous, isn't it? But it's, no one seems to be really taking, I may be wrong in this, but I just don't get the feeling that people are really investing in the talent and the opportunity that Pakistan offers.
Yeah, no, I think you have it right. You're 100% correct in saying this, because Pakistan does have a lot of potential. There's so much talent in this in Pakistan. And it makes me really sad when I see that all of that talent going to waste just because there are no opportunities for those writers. I do think that the Big Five do have offices in India. So they're doing a lot for regional authors. And they were publishing a lot of South Asian, Pakistani authors as well. But as you probably know, that India and Pakistan aren't always on the best of terms. So we have a trade ban in place. So that has sort of stopped any author in Pakistan to get published in India. Because if these publishers can't send their books to Pakistan, then what's the point of publishing Pakistani authors? Because at the end of the day, I mean, no matter how noble your intentions are, you have to eat. So they have to make a business decision at the end of the day. They can't just publish Pakistani authors and not sell any copies at all. So that's another reason and another sort of avenue that's dried up for Pakistani authors. So it's even more harder now. And it's just the government is no use. I mean, they literally could not care less because they're the ones who put the trade ban in place. So if they had any such thing where they wanted to support us, they would have. But we don't have any prizes. We don't have any grants. We don't have any creative writing programs. Nothing at all in Pakistan. So, yeah.
That's surprising.
It's tragic.
It is tragic. It surprises me, given, you know, who's in charge of the country in Imran Khan. Although he always catches, you know, he surprises me all the time anyway, because you would think with his level of his background, his Oxford education, his time in English county cricket, you know, he's travelled the world, that this is the sort of thing that he would want to see happening. But that doesn't, I don't get that feeling from him at the moment.
No, I think he's quite transformed as soon as he became prime minister. So it's not the old Imran anymore. But I think maybe he has his heart in the right place. But Pakistan is not a country that you can change overnight. So it has to be done in a, I don't know. I think at this point he's doing more harm than good. If you look at the things that are happening in Pakistan, the oil prices are sky high. The dollar is like, the pound is 236 rupees, £1. So you can imagine, I was like, you know, if I stay in London anymore, I'll be on the streets, literally.
Yes.
It's really expensive, yeah.
Yeah, and of course, you know, there is such a difficult geopolitical situation at the moment, and Pakistan well, I mean, they don't quite know where to point because India are quite cozy with Russia at the moment. And so there's that. But there's also this antipathy towards the United States and the West after what's happened in Afghanistan and the militants that are in Pakistan. We're going already off feast from writing, but it's important to set the context for what you're trying to do creatively in the situation and the culture and the society that you're currently writing in. It's not an easy thing, especially when you're tackling it as you have with your second book, you know, the question of honor and how that impacts women in your society. It's a very powerful subject in No Honor. So what sort of reaction when that was published did you get from the Pakistan community? Because, you know, there's a lot of people here who wouldn't want to touch that subject.
Yes, well, that's an excellent question. And like you said, it's a very sensitive subject for sure. And when you're, I mean, being a writer in Pakistan, you always have to be careful about how many sort of eyebrows you raise, how many eyebrows raised because of you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's always a concern. But I feel that to some extent, we do have a responsibility as writers to show what's actually going on in the country. And not just sugarcoat it all the time. I mean, I did get a lot of flack from some people in Pakistan who said that, you know, you're always portraying a bad image of Pakistan. And what about all the good things that happen in Pakistan? I'm like, nobody is discounting that. Of course, there are good things about Pakistan. There are good things about every country. But that doesn't mean just because there's so many good things about this, that the hardships and whatever those other people are going through, 90% of those people were struggling in life. It doesn't mean that their life is worth nothing, that we don't have a responsibility to talk about how they're living and how they're struggling. So just because life is good for the top 10% doesn't mean it's good for everyone in Pakistan. So that's what I think when I'm writing. I'm like, if you pay attention to your critics a lot, then you'll never have a happy day in your life.
Sure.
Yeah, you have to take it all with a pinch of salt. So yeah, I mean, I sort of try to take it in my stride, and but generally the response has been really good in Pakistan. I mean, people have been reaching out and telling me that I've tackled an important subject and I've written it sensitively, and it's not been sensationalized. So there is a lot of praise as well. So that's good.
But I think that's quite important, isn't it? I think if you don't ruffle any feathers with your book, I don't think you've quite succeeded. I think you need to ruffle feathers. In order to, you know, yeah. Make a mark.
Well, true art should ruffle feathers and make people, you know, and question, you know, think again and challenging questions, which I think, you know, you achieved, didn't you?
I know, and with both my books. So it's like literally whatever I write, there are always people who have a problem with it. So, so I guess that's a good thing.
I think it is a good thing. No, I definitely think it is. So what are you working on a book at the moment? What's your next project?
Oh, yes. So I have a 2-book deal with Orenda. So I'm writing another book for them. And I'm really excited because this one is pretty different. It's quite different from what I've written previously because this one is set between Lahore and London. So it has a little bit about the immigrant experience as well as to how Pakistanis feel and how they live. When they're abroad, especially when they're in the UK. So it's a little bit about that as well. So I can't go into any further details because then I'll be giving everything away. So
just a hint though, but that's quite an exciting hint.
Can we ask what the genre is or whether, you know, anything in that sort of bracket?
Absolutely. I mean, I think I'm more of a commercial literary fiction guy. So I don't even know about that. I mean, for me, writing is all about making it accessible. I want people to be able to read my book and not have to look at the glossary or the dictionary and, you know, wonder what that word means. So I don't want them to do that. I just want them to, you know, read the book, have a good time reading it and read it quickly. I want them to consider it an easy read because, you know, with today, with all these distractions, technology and Instagram and social media, Twitter, people want easy reads, something that they can dive right into and then get right out of. So that's what I aim for when I'm writing as well.
I think it's a myth, isn't it, that literary fiction has to be difficult to read or has to use words that you don't know. And I think that's not true at all. It's about how you use language. If you use language in an interesting way and a way that captures the imagination, it can still be understandable.
And to some extent, that's down to theme as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, those issues that you might challenge, that's, you know, but so in terms of that style, when you're revising a manuscript and looking at it again, what sort of things would you, when you look at it again and go, all right, that's coming out because that's taking the reader out of that feel that you're trying to create?
Sorry, I think I missed your question.
I'm sorry. Well, I'm just thinking, you know, in terms of when you're revising a manuscript and looking at it again, you know, when you've got your first draft and you're looking through it and maybe you're getting your edits back from your editor, what sort of issues second time around do you spot that get in the way of that sort of experience that you're trying to give the reader?
Well, I think for starters, there's always so many typos that you come across. It's like literally, I start questioning why I even am a writer. I'm like, who wrote this? It's like so many typos. But apart from that, I mean, at some point you have to put those aside and focus on the structural issues. So I do think that when you're self-editing, those structural issues will not jump out at you, as opposed to if you have a reader, like for example, if you have an editor or if you have a friend who is a writer as well. So if they will actually shed light to issues, structural issues that you might not be able to catch. I mean, I'm really good at line edits. I can do line edits really well, but I can't do structural edits. I sort of struggle with that because I don't know where I'm going wrong. So I need someone else's perspective here. So I really like working with editors and writer friends because they can offer me feedback that I can actually use. So
yeah,
but then again, I'm also very careful not to ask my regular friends to read it because they'll just tell me that this is the best thing they've ever read. That's when the work goes to an agent or a publisher. They're like, "What rubbish is this?" Then you realize,
that's true. It's like, so when Adrian has written something, if I like it, I think he's going to think I'm just saying I like it. So is he going to take me seriously? Well, I say, "Yeah, I really like that bit." So yeah, it's quite difficult, is it, when you're
it's interesting to say that because, I mean, I think some people, for them, the structure is the easy bit and it's the line editing is they can't do it because it's, you know, just requires too much concentration. They can't see the structure of a sentence particularly is catching, you know, or could be improved. Whereas other, you know, as you say, I mean, that's where you feel you need the support more than anything is on the structural side. When you were, I mean, I know that you've studied creative writing at Durham and other places, and this is a sort of you know, there's a strong theme in terms of when looking at your biog of sort of the self-improvement as a writer, which I think is fantastic. I mean, you know, I would encourage all writers to keep trying to improve. Have any books in that sort of field of structure or anything? Is there anything that you go back to and you think, this is one that helps me to see the wood from the trees?
Absolutely.
To quote one.
I'll be honest with you. Both of my degrees, Western Ontario and the Durham University one, they're not related to writing at all.
Really? Oh, I'm sorry.
As a Pakistani, we have, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Pakistani culture, but as Pakistanis, we are very much influenced by our parents. Because even after graduating and after coming back from studies, most people live with their parents in Pakistan. So mm-hmm. the parents play a very integral role in everything. So my parents made me do a degree in economics and psychology first, and then they made me do a master's in business management. I mean, they didn't make me, but they sort of suggested it. So after that, I remember when I was 25, I was like, now I would like to, you know, study the thing I actually wanted to study all along. So then I took the Faber course, and I took a lot of other creative writing courses along the way as well. I kept on honing my craft and everything, because I mean, let's face it, nobody's ever perfect. No matter how many books you've written, it's constant. It's a learning curve. I mean, you're always learning something or the other as a writer. So I do remember that there are two books that I do turn to. I remember there's one called The Writing Journey, The Writer's Journey. It's by, I've forgotten the name of the author, but it's a very popular book on creative writing. It's called The Writer's Journey. And the second one is called Sin and Syntax, which is really good for typos.
Oh, right. Yes. Fantastic. I mean, I have a colossal library, these things.
Oh, he does. He's a complete.
Well, it's the first thing I do if I go to Waterstones. And the first thing I'll do is I'll go to that section about writing.
How to write.
How to write, you know, next to the reference dictionaries. You know, probably not far away will be the business books. And I'll try and find something new that I haven't seen before. I love going to Foyles for that.
Oh, in I love going to Court. Foyles, full stop.
Well, full stop. Who wouldn't want to go to Foyles? I mean, you could spend a lifetime in there. But I'm always looking for that little glint in whichever book. I mean, admittedly, a lot of it's repetitive now, but it's very important. That Faber course, then, which is very famous and very prestigious, how's that conducted? Because I've not really looked into it. Is it at all residential? Is it all done by correspondence? How's that done?
They have different options. So I took the 6-month online one first, which I took from Pakistan. But then I took the editing course in their London offices. However, I do feel that I learned more on the online course, because you sort of forge those connections, maybe because it was a 6-month thing. So the friendships you make and the people like you get to know, I took that 10 years ago, I think. And even today, I'm still in touch with most of those people. So they're kind of like my friends. So I met them for the first time like 5 years later or something, but it literally felt like I wasn't meeting them for the first time. It felt like any other day. So I think the best thing about the course, Faber course, is that it allows you that peer support. So the peer support and peer feedback that you get, that is so essential when it comes to writing. Because let's face it, how much can you actually teach someone about writing? Yes, I mean, you can learn how to write and everything, but at the end of the day, it's a very solitary activity. You are the one who has to actually put pen to paper and everything. And because it's a solitary activity, you do need the support of your like-minded people. So I think that's what the course really helps us with. And that's what I loved about it.
And everyone's got their own style anyway, haven't they? So we all write in our own quirky way.
Well, I think so. But we can also be influenced, clearly. But in terms of those relationships, you know, that's great that even on an online course, you can build those friendships. I mean, you know, we were just reflecting on, we went back to our old university last week in Exeter, and the friendships there, those are the ones that have endured most out of my life. The ones the people I refer to most and talk to most, I suppose, outside of family life, are the ones I still live alongside. You build those bonds, but that was in a face-to-face context. So to build them online is fantastic. So
I was just about that. I'm guessing they're from all over the world as well. They're sort of your group of course mates?
Online one, yeah. I think I took the first one ever. I think all of them, apart from two of us, were most of them were based in UK and Ireland. One of them, I think, was from Russia, and the other one, I mean, from Pakistan, it was me. So yeah, it's still predominantly UK and Ireland based, but I think I'm sure it's probably grown a lot over the years, and it's pretty much diverse now. So yeah, I mean, because the thing is that there's so many people out there, and also in every country who want to learn how to write, and you can learn how to write. I mean, the people who say that writing talent is in it, it's just a bunch of lies, to be honest. I mean, if you looked at my writing from 12 years ago or 15 years ago, you'd have laughed at me. It was so bad. So I've improved. I've learned how to write over the years. So I think that's something definitely you can do. You can learn.
Mm. And in terms of your writing day or your craft, I mean, what's an average day for you in terms of writing? Do you commit every day to a certain goal, or is it more when the muse takes you?
No, I'm definitely the muse sort of person.
Yeah.
I can go months without writing anything, because the fact is that it's not actually to do with the muse either. I'm very good at deadlines. So if you put a deadline on me, then I will deliver it to you on that deadline. But if you don't do it, then I'll keep dawdling and dawdling and dawdling forever.
Hello.
That's why I think it's so hard sort of write that first novel, because you don't have an agent, you don't have a publisher. It's all down to you. So the first book is so difficult to get out. But once you have an agent and a publisher, they keep pushing you and they're like, okay, please send it to me. Please send it to me. So I work well with that, because my agent has been pestering me like anything for book three now. She's like, almost a year. When are you sending it to me? So she keeps on giving me deadlines, but not that strong deadline. The one that, you know, that there's no explanation over, no, that's not going to get extended or whatever. So I was like, so she hasn't given me that yet. So I'm waiting for that. And then I'll really pull up my socks and start working.
Oh, that's interesting. I know I'm very much, you know, need a deadline right upon me to produce the goods, really. It's always been my way of working. You know, I mean, I wish I could be that person.
But the thing is, I don't think you should wish you could be that person, because...
Well, it would take a lot of stress out of my life. But then again, I find the stress is what makes me creative.
Yeah, exactly. It's when it's beaten down on you, saying, do it now, that you come up with a...
And yeah, so... I mean, why should writing be treated as different from any other sort of career or opportunity? I mean, we work really well with deadlines when we're running a business or when we're at a job or whatever. So I think writing can really fall into that as well. And I mean, it works for me. If I'm given a deadline, I deliver on that deadline. So yeah,
sure.
Really good for creativity.
Fantastic. I mean, I can think back to my own time with essay crises.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean,
I used to post on my door at Exeter in my first year. I used to have a sort of scoreboard telling people where I was with, I'd have to write usually four essays a term. And you know, final, you know, important ones. And I have a scoreboard on my door, you know, 1.5 done, 2.5 to go, 23 hours and 6 minutes left, you know, that kind of thing. And that's how I've always operated. I suppose I've just got to accept that that's the way it is.
Yeah. So
it frustrates the hell out of people professionally, though. And it frustrates you too.
Well, no, because I know if I say, for example, he's proofreading one of our books at the moment, and I say, if we don't get this proofread by such and such a day, we can't publish in the month that we want to publish in. And he's been doing it.
Yeah, I have.
Absolutely. Nothing like a good deadline. And that's like someone who actually enforces that deadline on you. That's equally important, I think. You know, the importance of that person matters a lot as well, because if it's someone that you listen to, then you do follow that deadline.
Absolutely. So in terms of you say you buy a lot of books and read a lot of books, which author do you think's been the most influential on inspiring you?
Inspiring me. I remember, I mean, like we were discussing Harry Potter, I think Harry Potter is definitely a book that has really inspired me, because I grew up reading Harry Potter. So, but then having said that, as far as writing is concerned, I remember I read Donna Tartt's The Secret History. I'd
love that book.
Yeah. I went to Goldfinch. I was like, yeah, it's good. It's a good book. It's won the award. It's good enough. I was like, okay, let's pick up The Secret History. Let's see what that's like. And then I couldn't put it down. I was like, this is her best book. Why isn't this more recognized than The Goldfinch? And I'm at a loss as to why people don't like it more than The Goldfinch. It's one of the best books I've ever read.
It's brilliant. I had the same experience. It was a colleague I worked with when I worked at Oxford University Press. She said, oh, you have to read this book. It's one of the best books ever written. And I thought, and it was a really tatty copy as well that she got from a charity shop. So I thought, okay, I've got nothing to lose. Couldn't put it down. It's brilliant. I think it's one of the best sort of, because it has got a sort of a thriller element to it, hasn't it? And it's about sort of psychology and what motivates people. It's brilliant. I love it. So good choice.
Well, I'll have to add it to my list.
Yeah, all those genres thrown together, it's kind of like a mixed genre book, and it's really, really good. I literally, one of the few books I didn't want to end. I didn't want them to end at all.
And apparently took her 10 years to write.
Well, she did a great job then. That's 10 years well spent.
Fantastic.
I think so.
Yeah. In terms of, you know, now that you're a published author and you know, your books have gathered a lot of acclaim and sort of building momentum around your career, have you met any of your sort of literary contemporaries or heroes, in recent times? Have you started to build relationships within the publishing community?
Well, I always like to meet writers and publishers and agents. I mean, I've been friends with a lot. I mean, I've been doing this for, 7 years now, I think. I've been coming to London 7 years now, I think. So, yeah, I've been... I'm friends with a lot of good agents, and I'm not friends with publishers as well, even crime publishers that I have no connection with as far as my books are concerned. But still, it's nice to meet, it's nice to network, and nice to build friendships and everything. So I do love to do that. And as far as my literary, the people I've grown up reading or the ones I look up to, like those writers, I have yet to meet them. I don't think they'd want to meet me yet. So
if you're watching, Donna, come on over, come visit.
Yeah, if you're listening, Donna, then yeah, I'd love to meet you.
We'll get her on the podcast.
We will. We'll have to. Yeah, you can do that one. You can make that approach. In terms of where you want to take your writing next, I mean, obviously, you've got your 3-book deal with Arenda, and that's fantastic. But have you any sort of... aspiration, you know, changing genre or style or anything that you're sort of aching to do away perhaps from sort of having the imperative of a contract? Where do you see, you know, things developing over the next 10 years, say?
Well, I don't know, but I think you probably have some sort of a, I don't know, how are you managing to read my mind right now? Because that is exactly what I was thinking just now, that I do have certain aspirations, but like you said, I am a literary commercial fiction author and I am recognized as that. But yeah. I do have a penchant for writing young adult, dystopian YA. I love writing that. And so I've been working on a series that under a pseudonym, of course. I just finished the first part. I've been writing it for a very long time now, a few years now. So it's part of a trilogy, and I've shown it to my agent as well, and she absolutely loved it. So it's under a pseudonym. So let's see what happens to that. But yeah, to answer your question, I'd love to sort of venture out of my the genre that I'm recognized in, but I don't think readers want to accept readers like that. They feel confused if that happens. So you do definitely have to change your name or sort of use a pseudonym or something like that.
That's yeah, that is a challenge.
How about
it?
Sci-fi romance?
Sorry?
Sci-fi romance.
Oh yeah. So mine is kind of like dystopian YA. So yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And YA. I mean, you know, it's such a big market. If you can capture the hearts.
Oh, you'll have to get on TikTok if you're into the YA.
That's an interesting question in terms of marketing efforts. How engaged are you with social media in terms of, you know, getting the word out there about your writing?
I love social media, to be honest. I'm not going to lie. I think people generally have a very difficult relationship with social media, but mine is pretty straightforward. I love connecting with people. I love talking to people on social media. I spend a lot of time on it. And I think that it's starting to sort of benefit me now as well. Even if you put book sales or writing or books aside for a bit, you connect with so many wonderful people on social media. I mean, I had no idea. Twitter was so amazing. And I mean, as good as Twitter can be, sometimes it can be very savage as well. So, but I've discovered the good side of Twitter, and I'm so glad that I did it. I found so many wonderful writer friends on Twitter that I've never even met, but it feels like we've been friends forever. And apart from that, I've also been connected with a lot of people on Instagram. I've gotten invitations to book festivals and literary festivals through my Instagram account. So it means that social media is a very important tool these days, and something that does get you noticed. I wish I knew how to do TikTok. I believe me, I want nothing more than to be that TikTok star who sells 1,000 copies or whatever. But sadly, I have only 2 followers on TikTok.
Oh, we'll follow you. So we started TikTok. We set up the account in about October, and we had 7 followers for 3 months, didn't we?
Yep.
And then since January, I've got really into it, and now we have 400. So we're getting there. But I'll seek you out, and Hobeck will follow you.
I'm an author on everywhere. So everywhere I'm a Vescon author. But yeah, I think I'm gonna figure out TikTok while I'm in London as well. Probably make some nice videos in the sun or something, because we don't get enough of the sun in Lahore. I mean, it's very sunny, yes, it's very hot, but most of the time we have this huge layer, thick layer of smog over the city. So it's really, really difficult to get fresh air there. So maybe
absolutely. Well, I mean, my experience of traveling around India, you know, that's very much, part of life, isn't it? But indeed, there are so many cities where that's the case. I wanted to go back to something you said earlier about your parents, because clearly they, you know, their influence took you down a path that then when you were 25, you were able to pursue your dream. How do they feel about your writing now? But what's your real, your real job is X as opposed to, the writing. How do they react?
I'll say this about my parents, that they've been very supportive. They're not like conventional Pakistani parents. I mean, they never stopped me. I mean, obviously they advised me to go to take this degree, that this will benefit me in the future and everything. And, being a 17-year-old at that time, I didn't even think twice. I was like, whatever my parents say is right.
Sure.
So, but after that, I mean, they never really forced anything on me. I mean, I do work in the family business a little bit. I help out and I run a creative writing program as well on my own under the name of the Writing Institute, which is something I want to do to improve things in Pakistan. And I write as well. They've never said anything. I mean, I don't think they read my books, but they're very, very supportive generally. So, yeah.
Tell us about that then, the Creative Writing Institute that you're running. How many students do you have? And what's that sort of opportunity? How do they responded to that opportunity?
Yeah, so basically, I remember when I came back from London in 2016, I thought that there should be something like the Faber thing in Pakistan as well. Of course, nobody can afford £3,800 for a 6-month course. I mean, that in Pakistan, people can't. I mean, if you calculate it, I mean, even if you multiply it by 200, that comes up to around 800,000 rupees, which a normal person, I'll tell you, a normal person in Pakistan earns between 20,000 to 30,000 rupees. And so you can imagine how not everyone can afford an 800,000 rupee course. So I wanted something like that. So I set up the Writing Institute, and initially I didn't have a physical space. So I hosted my courses in hotels and conference rooms, etc. And it was a huge loss. I lost a lot of money initially because obviously the word of mouth wasn't there. There were very few people who showed up. Most of them didn't want to pay. So, but slowly, I think a year later, I kept at it. I kept incurring losses, but because I wanted to do this. And then, magically one fine day, my first course turned a profit. And then ever since, it's been, it's got more and more profitable. But in 2020, I had to shut the physical institution down because of COVID. Obviously, it didn't make sense anymore. So I was like, here we are once again. I'm back to square one. But then someone suggested that why not try online courses, because people have a lot of time these days, and then you can cater to a lot of people outside Pakistan as well. So I gave it some thought. I set up a website, I set up a payment system, and then I started announcing online courses. And it literally has been doing much better than my physical classes even. So it's done really well. And I think I've taught around almost 10,000 people since I started. Yeah.
That's astonishing.
That's a great achievement. Yeah, I love that.
That is amazing. So, have you got anybody, to the stage where they're working on their manuscripts and are ready to submit? How does that work?
Plenty of people. I mean, a lot of people of mine have got on to get published even. I wouldn't take any credit myself. I mean, it's just a course with me. It's a 6-week, 5-week course, so I can't really take the credit. But it's just to show that they have so much talent that they have gone on to get published. I mean, one of my students was Anne Blockswich, whose books...
Yes. We know Anne Blockswich, yes.
Yeah, we know Anne well, yeah.
She was my student, and Christy Newport was my student. Who's now with Joff Books. So I, like I said, I'm not taking any credit at all. They were already very talented. But just to show that there are people, and there's so many people in Pakistan. There's Minal Mohsen, who goes by the name Minal Mann. She's also published now, and there are a lot of other people I know.
Oh, that's wonderful, isn't it? Like you say, it is partly about the confidence. It's like, because they might have just kept their manuscripts and just put it in the drawer and left it there and...
Are you tempted at some stage to become a publisher and
Yeah. I always wanted to be a publisher, but now that I've seen how hard it is, I'm like, no thanks.
Great answer.
It's so hard. I mean, it's like the big five take everything. It's like they have control of everything. And it makes me so sad when I see such amazing books, so well-deserving books that don't get the necessary attention that they should. So I'm like, I'm not coming close to this industry. There's very little money and too much hassle.
Yeah, I'm beginning to think you're right.
Beginning? We always knew that, but we still did it.
No, exactly. That's a very fair point. I ask that because, clearly you've taken took a huge gamble with the when you started the academy, and that's, and it's paid off now. But in terms of giving Pakistani writers access out there, that is something that, there needs to be a sort of Pakistani publishing.
Like a link, yeah.
Yeah, sort of industry.
I think we're saying you'd be the perfect person for the job.
Yeah, we're pushing you in front of that vanguard there.
No, I'd love that there should be like a South Asian or Pakistani imprint of, UK-based publishers or whatever. Mm. Yeah, that would be interesting indeed, especially because there are readers in Pakistan. I mean, we do have a huge issue with piracy, of course, in Pakistan, but still there is a great deal of readership in Pakistan. So yeah, that's something definitely I would look into maybe in the future once I have a lot more money saved up.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, well, it's something we need to think about.
Is it that time?
Yeah, when I say that, that it's time for a random question and see where this one goes. But I will give it the build-up as I normally do, and I shall probably put tons of audio effects all over this. But I shall now say Rebecca's random question.
So, like I said, it came from my 12-year-old son, and I had just been moaning about the fact that summer is coming soon and I will have to start mowing the lawn every other week. And Toby's question is, do you like gardening?
Me? No. Not all. I do love hanging out in gardens and stuff. I do like admiring flowers and admiring a well-mown lawn. That's something I do like, but only from a distance.
Well, he also wants to know, do you like trees?
Oh, I love trees. Yeah, I absolutely love them. I back when I was a kid, I think probably when I was his age, 12, 13, I had a huge infatuation with tree. I had a huge infatuation with botany. So I bought a book where there were different tree types, and I'd, roam around Lahore holding up that book and comparing those trees with what the picture said. Then I discovered trees like those pine trees, and I was like, okay, Lahore has pine trees. And then there were the ones that shed their leaves in winter. So that's something that really interested me. And then the evergreen ones. So it was like, it was a huge infatuation back in the day. But I think over the years, it's sort of dulled down. Now I'm not that
climbing trees. Did you used to climb trees when you were a child?
With my upper body strength, I you'd be lucky to get me off the chair.
I love climbing trees.
I can imagine that, but I couldn't do it. But I could do, you know, like you, I didn't have the upper body strength, but also I didn't have the courage.
I have a book and a drink, and I'd go climb a tree and sit and read in a book all day.
But I mean, good luck getting me on a tree, though. You'd probably have to get a crane or something to actually get me on that tree and then get me off again.
Yeah, you need a cherry picker. Exactly right. Yeah, no, I'm not one for sitting in a, you know, okay, it's a natural environment, but no, sorry. You know, I'll be in the deck chair beneath it.
No, I do love trees. I do love sitting in trees.
It looks so easy because I used to see rock climbing and I was like, look at that. It looks like a piece of cake. You know, it looks like a cakewalk, literally. And I tried it once, rock climbing, and I literally could not climb a single one of those pegs or whatever that is. I was like, what is this? What is happening to me? And they were like, now you know, it's not that easy.
No, it isn't. It really isn't. No, it's not for me at all. Well, that's a very erudite question from Toby.
Yeah.
It always is with him.
And I said, what if the answer's no? No, I don't like gardening.
And I was brought up in a family of gardeners, and as a rebel, I've never enjoyed it. But my sister, my God, she loves it.
Oh, your sister was brilliant because his sister came to visit, and she gave me all these tips saying, you need to trim that in whatever month, and you need to do something with that one, and you shouldn't have that one there. That should go over there.
Yeah,
I don't know much about it.
I'm ashamed of my lack of knowledge of gardening, I must admit. Anyway, so what have you got planned for the rest of your visit?
Well, I'm going to be meeting a lot of people. Hopefully, I'll be able to do that. I hope I don't get COVID or anything here, but I think I've had it twice already. And I'm like more than vaccinated. So it's like as good as it gets. I can't be any more protected than I already am. So I'm just going to throw caution to the winds and meet people and at a safe distance, maybe. And I'm supposed to be meeting my publisher, my agent, and some other agents as well who are my friends. And a lot of writer friends, of course, and hopefully we'll be appearing on some radio shows and some TV shows as well, if all goes well. So there's plenty to do. And, you know, being in London is like a sort of a cure in itself. I love going to that. I'm sure you know of that place. Have you been to that Russell Square? So there's this place called the Brunswick. Love that. It's like it has Nando's, which is my favorite restaurant in London. So I always have lunch at Nando's, and then I hop on to the Starbucks next door, and I ride and I have fun. It has these huge windows where you can see all the people milling about and everything. So being in London in itself is kind of like amazing. So I'm really looking forward to spending more time here.
Sounds like you're going to be very busy and book shopping to fill your suitcase.
Oh yeah, I totally forgot that. Of course, you'll be finding me in a bookshop, in lots of bookshops, buying books. I was actually at St. Pancras yesterday. I was buying a ticket and there was Hatchards and I was like, there we go. So I just went in and I looked at that table display and I was like, I can't buy them all. How will I carry them? So I looked at Laura Shepherd Robinson's book that's just come out. It's called The Daughters of the Night. And the sprayed edges were so beautiful. I was like, that's it. I bought it.
Sold.
I have a thing for sprayed edges. I can't resist a good sprayed edge book. So, yeah.
Nor can I actually. That's true.
It does make a difference, doesn't it? I mean, you were saying that you like the physical form of a book, and I'm the same. You know, we are publishers, I would say digital first, really, but I don't own a Kindle.
That's a confession.
I do have a Kindle. I get along on a Kindle, it's fine, but nothing like an actual book. I mean, there's nothing at all like that. Yeah.
Well, we wish you a fantastic trip and all the success for the future.
Thank you so much.
It's been great having you on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you so much for making my Sunday so cheerful. And I really liked doing this, and I hope that, you know, if you ever visit London during this month, So do get in touch. I'd love to see you.
Yeah, we'll have a coffee and go to a bookshop.
Really looking forward to it.
Or we could go to Nando's on Russell Square, because you'd like
that. Well, I hit Nando's last night in Sheffield, yeah.
Yeah, let's do that.
Fantastic. Thank you always.
Thank you.
Wonderful and positive and such an uplifting interview.
Oh, he's lovely. I feel like we've made another new friend, definitely.
Yeah, we are planning. I mean, he's over here for the month, so we'll be down in London before he leaves. So hopefully we'll meet up for a coffee. And
a bookshop wonder, I think.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. Absolutely. Thank you, Oase. And, of course, his most recent book, No Honour, is available at all good outlets.
Absolutely.
Well, it's going to be a busy week this week.
Is it never not?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I've noticed that you work so hard, and this period of the year is the toughest bit for you because you've got various things on the go, not
so
just Hoback.
It's the Writers and Artists Yearbook. I absolutely love working on this project, but January, February, March, April, May, the 5 months when I'm working on it, are always very busy. And March in particular, when we sort of start, just before we start proofreading it. So I've had my head in that book for a week.
Yeah, that's absolutely it. You've got to double check all the information that you're responsible for.
Yeah, it's quite important because writers, prospective writers, they rely on that information. And if anything's not out of date or untrue, then yeah, we feel very responsible for that. So
that's what you're working through alongside Hoback's stuff. So I'm taking on some proofreading this week.
You are. I've given you a couple of projects, haven't I?
You have. Now, I'm not the world's natural proofreader in terms of concentration span, but so far, I've done okay.
I'm very impressed. Every time I've gone in the kitchen, you've been there with your headphones on, the look of concentration on your face, and I can dance around naked and you wouldn't notice. You're so into your proofreading at the moment.
I am. Well, I'm working on Jonathan Peace's Dirty Little Secret, which is out pretty soon, and then we've got Harry Fisher's Yes, I Killed Her, which is going to be landing on our desks this week, and yeah. So I'll work on that too. So I'm enjoying that. I'm also narrating at the moment, and I've been working on Malcolm Hollingdrake's Sin this week, and I just, yeah, this time it's, I tried recording it a few weeks ago and just wasn't gelling, and then I've changed some equipment in the studio, and suddenly the difference is remarkable in terms of the narration side of things. So it's just made all the difference in terms of the performance I can give.
It's true. And you played an extract to me last week, didn't you? And I it was amazing, in my opinion. You know, the difference, the sort of the depth to it.
Yeah.
It's a lot stronger, so.
Yeah. So, you know, that's something else to think about. You've got a fair bit of, you know, travelling to do this week as well, haven't you?
Yeah, helping my mother.
She had a fall.
She had a fall on Monday, so we're popping over to the hospital on Monday. On Wednesday, I'm going to a place of higher education with my eldest child, who's applying for university at the moment. So we're going to Manchester to check it out. So that'll be a bit of a jolly.
I'll be in Manchester on Tuesday for Manchester United against Atletico Madrid.
And you're having coffee with an old colleague, aren't you, on Tuesday?
I am. So yeah.
Very busy week.
A busy week, but you know, enjoyable nonetheless. And we're looking forward to London Book Fair, where I can exclusively reveal we're going to be talking to somebody random I don't even know yet about audiobook advice.
Are you? That's fantastic.
Yeah,
I'm
absolutely
looking forward to that.
Yeah, we've already got some meetings set up and more to come. So you know, that's going to be very intense 3 days. I think
we're going to be really, really busy.
We are, but we're looking forward to it. And you know, I haven't been to London for ages, for a couple of years nearly.
I'm trying to think. Oh, I went to London fairly recently, didn't I, to go and watch Six, I think it's called, the Henry VIII Wife musical, which is brilliant. But yeah, you haven't been for a long time.
No, I haven't. And, you know, I've got a lot of friends there and I'm missing them all. So it'd be good to catch up. But most of all, it's important to get some deals done while we're there. So we're looking forward to London Book Fair. We're getting our ducks in a row with that one, so
yes,
to speak. Anyway, let's just remind you where you can find things Hoback online. www.hoback.net is our home. Plenty there. New blog from you this week.
Yes, I wrote a new blog. Yes, I just got inspired. And I haven't written a blog for a long time, so it was lovely to do that.
And a lovely picture of Ken Masters from Howard's Way.
Oh, he's a dish, isn't he?
he's 80s man writ large, isn't he? Anyway, that was your contribution, fresh contribution this week. And of course, at that website, you can find out all about our authors. We are on the cusp of another author announcement, so look out for that too.
Yeah, very soon.
Very soon. And we have our audiobooks on display there too, of which Mark Whiteman's Waking the Tiger is now available on Audible, to add to all the other platforms that it's available on. So check that out. If you buy it from our Author Direct website, Shopfront, then there are discounts on all of our audiobooks, should you wish to listen to those.
It's so, definitely worth doing. If you don't subscribe to Audible, which I know a lot of people don't, not everybody does, yeah, it's worth having a look.
Absolutely. Well, that leaves us to say thank you very much for joining us this week. We hope you've enjoyed the Hobcast Book Show. Next week, we are talking to one of the people behind
Chill with a Book Award. I always stumble over saying that. So Pauline, lovely Pauline, she set up this all herself. You know, she's done it all. Mm. She wants to champion self-published and independent authors and independent publishers by offering this award, or slightly different awards. There's a cover award, there's a book of the month,
the premiere award.
Yeah.
So, well, quite a number of our authors won Chill with a Book Awards in the last couple of weeks, and we even got cover of the month for...
We did.
Yeah, with J Mack's cover for Brian Price's Fatal Trade was the book cover of the month, which is fantastic. So we'll talk to Pauline next week, and we'll talk to you next week, hopefully, as well. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. The Hobcast Book Show is available on about 13 different platforms now. Subscribe wherever you got it from, and we'll catch you next week. So from myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, who I'm about to cook some roast beef, Rebecca Collins.
Thank you so much for listening, and we wish you a wonderful and creative week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast, and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.